factors do you think were responsible for that collapse in the 50s and 60s, which you addressed in that book?
The book I wrote in 65 was called The Secular City.
The Secular City. I'm sorry.
The one this year is called Religion in the Secular City. Well, a lot of things have happened in the last 20 years to raise the kinds of questions that I addressed in my new book. One is that all of the predictions that we once heard that religion would be declining or would become a strictly private or individual affair, whatever else happened, that religion would not play any role in the public political arena. These predictions just didn't work out that way. And I think that raises the whole question of why they didn't work out that way. What happened that these sociological forecasts were so dramatically mistaken? And I think there are a number of reasons for it. One is that the promise of science and technology, which was so much a part of the modern mood, the whole confidence that we had that education would somehow solve things for us, don't seem to have delivered for some people the kind of promise that was held out. And we see everywhere less confidence now that simply educating people or that the forward march of science is going to really get us any closer to the kingdom of God or to utopia or something of that nature. Also, I think religion never really did disappear. It was merely the fact that ruling elites tended to be less religious than the people they ruled over. Whether this was true in the United States or in Europe or in the Soviet Union or anywhere else, the people, the masses tended to retain a larger interest and participation and loyalty to traditional religions than the educated elites do. And what we now see happening in a lot of places is the emergence of these large numbers of the masses of people into a more prominent role. This is especially happening in the third world, but also in other parts of the world. So I think all of these things combine to raise the kinds of questions that I try to deal with in this new book.
So you think that when some people started leaving religion, they were hoping that science or even like urban society could replace religion and offer some kind of framework that they could build their lives on, but it failed to. It didn't offer that, and that now people are turning back to religion instead?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, that there was an exaggerated hope for what science might do for us. My favorite illustration for that is all the hopes that were placed on communications, that if people could only be in touch with each other, somehow that would cause peace and understanding and so on. And I remember reading during the time of when the American hostages were being held in the embassy in Tehran, that there was a daily phone contact between the embassy there and the State Department in Washington. People were very closely in touch with each other, but it didn't seem to produce the kind of understanding and agreement. So I think there's been a reassessment of the exaggerated hopes for science. People still have a justifiable confidence that science will solve certain things, especially in the whole field of medical treatment, but the exaggerated hopes are gone.
Well, in 1965, you wrote The Secular City, and now you've written a book saying, well, no, there's a resurgence of religion. What were the first signs that you saw that made you realize that the trend away from religion was shifting?
Mm-hmm. I think the first signs that I noticed were the appearances in the United States of considerable interest in Asian religions. That took place mainly in the 1970s. A lot of interest in meditation practices and in mysticism and in Hindu devotions and in this. I even wrote a book on that called it Turning East back in the 1970s, trying to understand where that was coming from. And as I investigated it, it became clear to me that this can only go so far, that being Westerners, it was a book about the United States, being Westerners, our attraction for these Asian religious practices could only go up to a certain point. Then there would probably be some kind of a rebound or a effort to to recuperate certain aspects of our own religious traditions that have been set aside. So that's where it first came to my attention.
You say that now the revival of religion isn't happening from the mainstream. It's not in the center. It's rather on the periphery. What are some examples of that?
Well, I think if you look around the world, what you notice at the edges of what we call the modern world, for example, in Poland, in Africa, in the Arab countries, in Latin America, this phenomenon of religion coming back into the world of public political discourse is and political action is very evident. Ireland, I mean, sometimes it's for the good, sometimes it's very, very negative. And what I try to do in this book is face the whole gamut of possibilities. Sometimes it's good news and sometimes it's bad news. But it seems to be happening more in those parts of the world which have not been at the center of power and privilege and rule during the 19th and 20th centuries, including in our own country, I might say. Because I include movements, for example, among feminists and the reemergence of the black churches here. So on a world scale and on a national scale, that's where it seems to be coming from, what I call the bottom and the edges.
And it's happening on the left and on the right politically.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you see any fundamental similarities between the resurgence of religion on the right as typified by, say, the fundamentalists or Jerry Falwell, and on the left as typified by liberation theology? And you use Ernesto Cardinal as an example of a leader of that.
One of the surprises that came to me as I wrote this book was that I chose Latin American liberation theology and North American political fundamentalism as sort of extreme examples on the left and on the right of this reemergence of political religion. I did not expect to find as many structural similarities between the two as I found when I started writing the book. For example, one of the similarities is that they both create a kind of leadership which is not the standard leadership, which leadership legitimated by educational or ecclesiastical licensing. There's a certain kind of leadership which emerges, which has quite a different quality about it. Also, they don't seem to go along the traditional Catholic Protestant lines. I mean, you find in both these movements people from across denominational borders who seem to find each other in ways that that previously might have kept them apart. Another thing about them is, although in a very different way, they are critical of recent theological and religious tendencies on the basis of what they think is the more original product. They want to go back to the Bible, back to early Christianity, back to a more primitive or pure state of the religious tradition, and they criticize recent developments within the last 100 years or so as being a deviation. Now, I don't think I want to overdo the similarity. I think there are structural similarities, but the content of these two movements is very different indeed, and they come out in very different places, and I don't want to be heard to be equating them. I'm really not.
But both the fundamentalist right in America and the liberation theology movement of Central America preach social action in conjunction mm-hmm. with religion. Do you think that that's part of the new religion that we're seeing now, that that's part of the reason for the resurgence of religion that we're seeing, this need to have some kind of congruence between your moral religious views and the social political views that you
hold? Yes, I think that's definitely the case, and that is another similarity that, albeit in very different ways and with different goals, they both feel that the separation of the personal and religious or spiritual dimension from the public moral political dimension is wrong, that is a dichotomy which people shouldn't settle for, that their life is one and that one should influence the other. That's true. And I think part of that may be due to the fact that if religious language and imagery is barred completely from the political realm, a lot of people feel disenfranchised. A lot of people feel they don't have any access to the discussion that's going on. It sounds distant. It sounds technical. It sounds like something that they are not invited to be a part of. And this, in a sense, gives them an entree. They can begin to understand nuclear weapons or poverty or hunger or national political issues from their own moral vantage point once that happens. So I think in that sense, it's not a passing bleep on the screen. I think this is really something we're going to have to learn to live with and may even eventually make a quite positive contribution by getting more people involved in the political process.
Well, is this a trend that concerns you? Because I think that maybe people have a double standard about religion and politics, and that, you know, some people would support religion and politics when it's coming from a liberal direction, but not when it's coming from a conservative direction, or vice versa. As a theologian who's interested in all these issues and has kind of studied them and written on them for years, do you have any clear-cut places where you draw the line, where a point where you think that religion is getting too close to politics and ought to be kept out?
Well, I think you have to make a distinction between church and state, where you're talking about religious institutions, and about politics and religion, where you're talking about ideas. And in our constitutional system, the institutional separation of the state from the church is very important, and it has to be maintained and guarded very carefully, I think. However, the idea that one can separate ideas, the notion that one can separate political from moral, from religious ideas, is to me completely silly. It just can't be done. It's never been done. It would chop people up into little pieces that wouldn't work. So I think what we have to be very careful to maintain is the institutional separation between religious institutions and governmental institutions. And I think that goes both ways. I think the government has the responsibility to protect the freedom of religious institutions to teach, to preach, to get out their message, to try to persuade people. And when that is hampered or threatened in any way, the government has a very serious responsibility to protect that and to nurture it. And religious institutions have the obligation to make this message known insofar as they can. But the government also has to protect us from the imposition on us of the institutional power of any particular religious tradition or group. Now, sometimes the line is a little fine, sometimes the area is a bit gray, and it's hard to know exactly in the gray area where that distinction is to be made. It's a useful distinction mentally, but in practice it gets a bit fuzzy sometimes. But I'm not as concerned as many people are about some kind of spoilation of our democratic processes by having religious people speaking and teaching and advocating. I think we can not only take that, I think it adds to a certain amount of vigor and electricity to the debate. I'm not really worried about that.
You don't seem to be wholeheartedly pleased that there's this new resurgence in religion. You say that religion is always a mixed blessing. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think the problem always is that when you're talking about religion, you're talking about something that people have extremely strong feelings about. I mean, after all, religion, by definition, is the ultimate system or the ultimate belief system that people live by, that people are willing to live and die by. Therefore, the kind of commitment that people have to religious convictions tends to be very, very strong, even more so than some other kinds of convictions. Although I have to say that in the modern world, in the last 100 years or so, some people have become much more fanatically religious about their patriotism or other things like that. But then that becomes, for some people, a kind of a religion. So I think those of us who advocate, as I do, the freedom and even the obligation of religious groups and people to make known their views about public issues also have a very important obligation to protect the right of other and disagreeing parties and institutions to have the same privilege. and the same opportunity. And here's where I think we haven't always done as well as we might have.
But this is a point that you make about some of the new religions or the new ways of practicing religion, is that they're not always as tolerant of pluralism.
That's true. That's true. And one also has to say that sometimes secular philosophies have not been very tolerant of religion either. And there are the 20th century, especially, is one in which it hasn't only been religious movements that have been intolerant. Intolerance seems to be a quality that can be shared by religious, non-religious, and anti-religious movements. But I'm talking about something more, a little bit more than tolerance also. I think in our political system, I think I have the obligation not only to be tolerant of the other perspective, but to guarantee its safety and its security and its health as a contribution to a whole picture which without which we would all be impoverished. And I think that we're learning to do this better, you see. I think people learn by participating. And I think there's a lot of criticism of the fundamentalists for being intolerant of other people and so on. I think as they are drawn into the process and have to answer and have to respond and have to look for allies, they'll learn, as other parties have in the past, that this is the way things are done.
You spent some time with Jerry Falwell for your book, Religion in the Secular City. When you wanted to make an appointment to see him and when he knew that you were going to be in the church, was he uncomfortable by that, thinking that a Harvard theologian would be a liberal and would scorn the kind of religion that he stands for? Was he suspicious of you?
Well, if he was, he didn't give any evidence of being suspicious. I mean, I have always felt very warmly welcomed when I've been with him, and I've been with him on several occasions now, and have felt quite welcomed in his church and in his town. We disagree very fundamentally on a lot of things, but he seems to be the kind of person who is willing to listen and even seeks out other perspectives so that he can test his own and so on. And I think he's the kind of person also who is beginning to learn that what I just said previously, that if you go for everything and are not willing to compromise in the American system, you generally don't get anything. You have to look for allies, even if they're Harvard liberals or if they're, in his case, I mean, he's willing to make alliances. He told me, for example, and this is kind of funny, he said, I'm willing to form alliances with anybody, even with feminists. Now, he meant feminists around the issue of pornography, you see. That's what he was talking about. So that, for him, seemed like a very extreme example. But he knows that many feminists are uncomfortable about pornography. He is, too. Why not make alliances? Now, this is what I'm talking about. This is learning from the pluralistic mix of how you actually get things done in the political arena.
Well, he's become one of the masters of the electronic media. And that's something, I think, pretty new for organized religion, to have that kind of mass following on television. Yet at the same time, he seems to be opposed to a lot of modern values and modern technology. Mm. Do you think that that's a fundamental contradiction?
I do. I think it's a contradiction, and I think it's one of the reasons why I am not I don't think that the current political fundamentalist movement, relying as heavily as it does on mass media and computer mailings and so on, is going to continue to grow the way it has in the last few years and be as powerful as it has. His program is called the Old Time Gospel Hour. It's very significant. It's a nostalgic kind of religion. It appeals to what people like to believe has been lost and left behind of the good old days. But it uses, very uncritically, the most recent, flashiest electronic gimmickry and network television and computer mailings. And there is a built-in contradiction there. Whether you can really nurture traditional family values and small groups and tiny neighborhoods and the kinds of things that are pictured in a lot of that literature, using this community subverting technology that he's using, I think is a big, not just he, but many of the people who share his perspective, I think that's a built-in contradiction, and it's eventually going to cause real problems for the people who try to put those things together.
He sometimes uses his show as a platform for the political changes that he'd like to see. And it's also ironic to me, you mention in your book that he sees as his model Martin Luther King, whose politics were, of course, very different than Jerry Falwell's politics. Do you see them as being similar in the way that they use religion for their political goals?
I think there are some similarities and there are some differences. One important difference between the two is that when you challenge Jerry Falwell to make the connection between the Bible that he's holding and for example, his opposition to the nuclear freeze or his advocacy of an arms buildup, he doesn't quite know how to make the connection in the Bible itself. The Bible is more of a symbol for Falwell than an actual source of values and perspectives, I think. And he will, in a sense, he'll say that. He'll say, look, I believe in traditional values and the kinds of things we grew up with. That's what family values and things like that. Whereas Martin Luther King was a profoundly biblically oriented theologian with a training in theology up to the doctoral level and with his roots in the black church where the connection between the actual biblical stories and human justice issues are always made. So I think there are important differences that shouldn't be overlooked, even though taking into the public arena by a preacher of political concerns is similar in the two of them,
because of the emphasis on the past and older values and styles of the past of living. I always thought that fundamentalism must go back historically a long ways, but you place it to around 1910, which would make it a relatively new religion.
Yeah, it doesn't go back very far. Now, this is something that fundamentalists themselves don't like to concede, but even the term is a very new term. It came from about the turn of the century or slightly after that, and it came as a reaction to a certain kind of modern liberal theology, maybe an understandable reaction. But it, like any reaction, it's more rigid and more belligerent because it's a reaction to something. Whereas the tradition that Martin Luther King represents has a much older and deeper, going way back to the slave religion and going back to the early days of the black churches. And if anything, it's in response to racism or some other kind of oppression. I think you're also very, very correct in pointing out that the direction that these two guys are looking is very different. You have the old-time gospel hour. It's really a nostalgic view. And the most famous thing that Martin Luther King is known for is his vision, I have a dream of a time when children will not be judged by the color of their skin, by the quality of their character, and so on. He has this future, kind of prophetic vision that elicits a kind of posture toward tomorrow rather than yesterday. I think that's a very important distinction.
I know some fundamentalists believe that Armageddon is not far away, as the prophecies predict, and for some fundamentalists, that has become tied in with the possibility of nuclear wars, nuclear weapons being the instrument of Armageddon. Does Falwell believe in that, in the inevitability of Armageddon and its coming soon? And if so, what relationship does that have to his view of religion and social change?
Yeah, well, like any fundamentalist, he does believe in Armageddon, but I know that he does not believe that Armageddon can be equated with nuclear war, because mm-hmm. he said that publicly and just recently said that last week when there was some discussion about Armageddon. He has picked up a theme which has been present in a rather kind of subgroup of American fundamentalism, in which the Bible is read not just as a source of religious inspiration and ideas, but is also a predictive book in which, and we do know that in the Old Testament, the prophets were looking forward, let's say, to the liberation of Israel from its Babylonian captivity and so on. And it's a certain way of reading that, which in my view is mistaken, in which that is seen as a prediction of things that are still to happen in our future. And if you read the Bible that way and piece together some things from the Old Testament and the New Testament, you can come up with a kind of a scenario for the last days of history, which includes a great titanic battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil to take place in Israel in the Battle of Armageddon, in which God himself intervenes and all of that. But that, for Falwell, is not a nuclear war. That would and he opposes the view of some of his fellow fundamentalists who try to make that equation.
But if the end of the world is near, does that mean that one takes action in view of it, or that one kind of sits back and relaxes, has a good time until it comes?
Well, I mean, that's a question all of us have to face, isn't it? You know, when the Union of Concerned Scientists moves that little hand up toward 4 minutes or 3 minutes of 12, or somebody talks about the approaching Armageddon, what does that do to us? Does it make us despairing? Does it make us sit around on our and feel that we can't do anything? Or does it energize us to take some action? And I don't think there's any uniform answer to that, except that I'm sure that what the Union of Concerned Scientists want to do is to challenge us to take some action so that we don't hit midnight and come to some kind of cataclysmic end of civilization through a nuclear war. And I'm afraid that what a lot of the Armageddon theology does is to say this is already in the cards. It's the scenario is written, and there isn't really anything you can do about it at all. And I think to that sense, it's profoundly anti-biblical, anti-Christian. It's against the grain of the Judeo-Christian tradition in which human beings are created free and required to be responsible for and ethically responsible for history. I think it's a serious difference of opinion about that.
Fundamentalism is obviously meeting a lot of needs for its followers that mainline theology doesn't. What do you think some of those needs are, and do you think that fundamentalism is going to continue to grow, or do you think that there are certain questions that it's not responding to and that it would need to address in order to grow considerably beyond the place it's already reached?
Yeah, you see, I think it is responding to a lot of needs that are not being met adequately by other forms of theology. And that's one of the things I write about in this book, why I think we need what I call a postmodern theology. I think people like to know where they fit in the big picture. What's the story? What's going on? They turn on television, there are all these confusing reports and things coming in, flashing by them at 30-second intervals. And what a certain kind of fundamentalism does is to say, here's how it started, here's how it's going to end, here's where we are now, here's where you fit in. And there's a kind of a comfort at a certain level to that. And you see, it used to be that modern thought, let's say, had its own story. It was a story that evolution was moving ever upward and onward, or science was breaking new frontiers, or education was eventually going to make us all enlightened and tolerant people. And that doesn't seem very credible. That's what I was saying earlier on. It doesn't seem very credible. And I don't believe that you can counter one story with no story. I think we're people who congenitally, as human beings, like to be part of a larger story. This goes way back to the origins of the human race and the first bards and the first storytellers and the myths and the legends that have been And I think what we're doing now is groping for a new story. And that out of our religious traditions, there is emerging maybe a larger and more inclusive story. This is what I hope for, that we're drawing on various religious traditions and putting together something that has symbolic power, it has the kind of mythical energy about it, and allows people once again to feel that there is a beginning and a middle, and I have some role in this. And that's, in part, that's the job of theologians and religious scholars to work on and try to elaborate that sort of story. When you asked about the limitations of fundamentalism, one of the problems that they have to face all the time is that you can't expose people to alternative views too much. It has to maintain a kind of an insulation from radically different perspectives. And in a global world with so many messages and things going on, it's very hard to know how that can persist.
I'm speaking with Harvey Cox, who's a professor of divinity at the Harvard Divinity School and author of several books, the most recent of which is Religion in the Secular City. In your book, Religion in the Secular City, you also look at liberation theology as another alternative that's providing a kind of new way of telling the story or a new story and a different approach to religion. You seem to be more optimistic about its ability to actually sustain to sustain itself and to sustain the people who practice it. What's making you optimistic now about liberation theology?
Well, liberation theology is a distinctively bottom-up phenomenon. It's not something that was invented and distributed by either theologians or television evangelists. It's a quite remarkable religious movement in that it really emerged when the Catholic Church in Latin America organized large numbers of what are called base communities of people who did not have leadership from priests and who were simply helped to get together to read the biblical stories, especially the Gospels, discuss them, talk about them, and try to relate them to their own lives. And a kind of revival began of all over Latin America, quite a phenomenal thing. I compare it in my book to the Reformation of the 16th century that Luther and Calvin and others led, although that ultimately resulted in a break from the larger Catholic Church, and I think that's not necessarily going to be the case in Latin America. So it's grounded in numberless groups of people at the grassroots level and is bubbling up rather than being invented and distributed. And that gives me a lot more confidence that it will endure and grow. And it already is. I mean, it's had an enormous influence on other parts, especially of the poor parts of the world in Africa and Southeast Asia.
The people who practice liberation theology are coming into conflict with the Pope now. What do you see that conflict is being about? You've got the leader of the Catholic Church who is opposed to communism trying to eradicate religion, going to other Marxist countries and criticizing the priests there for being involved with the Marxist government, like in Central America, which he criticized Ernesto Cardenal and asked him to either take off his collar or step down from government.
Yeah. See, I don't think the dispute between the Pope and the liberation theologians has very much to do with Marxism, actually, although that's occasionally alluded to. I think the present Pope, John Paul II, is very, very committed to a traditional hierarchical structure in the Catholic Church, and he is made very uncomfortable by signs that the hierarchical pattern is being questioned or threatened by the growth of these communities, grassroots-based communities, in which people are taking responsibility for themselves, in which the conventional role of priestly leadership is not so strong, although there are a lot of priests who are involved, but they're involved in a more fraternal kind of way rather than some other kind of way. There's a lot of women who are leading these groups. There's a kind of a what should I say, a kind of reappropriation of the essential elements of the gospel from the gospel stories, which doesn't need to be mediated from a higher authority to the local level. And I think that tends to be the thing which makes him and some of the bishops uncomfortable. Now, not all the bishops. You mentioned Central America, but actually the country in Latin America in which the largest number of base communities has appeared and in which liberation theology is the largest force is Brazil. Brazil is really the pivotal center of the whole liberation theology movement. And there are many, many priests and bishops who are very much in favor of it, supportive of it, and encouraging it. So I don't think it's a doctrinal or issue at all. It has to do with the pattern of church organization, with what we call ecclesiology.
How does a base community compare to a typical church?
Well, I don't think I've ever run into something called atypical.
Typical church, right?
There are a lot of different churches, but I can tell you how it compares to most Catholic churches in Latin America, since this is largely a Catholic continent. They tend to be smaller. People tend to sit in a circle rather than facing front. They are much more participatory. There's singing, there's sharing of bread and food, there's telling of stories, there's prayers, and very centrally there is the reading of a story from the Gospels and then a discussion about it in which people bring in their own life experiences. I say the reading of the story because very often these are people who cannot themselves read, so one of the people who can read has to do that first. Now, that contrasts to a more, I should say, perhaps sacramentally oriented form of worship in which the priest and the action of the priest is central and in which if there is some use of the Bible, it's a sermon which the priest or someone gives and there isn't very much discussion about it usually. So it's a more democratic and more people-based form. And I want to say right again that I don't, I think one of the most encouraging things about it in Latin America is the degree to which elements of the Catholic hierarchy, bishops and cardinals, are enthusiastic about it as a true renaissance of Catholic spirituality across the continent. So, especially the bishops who are able to adjust to a new kind of leadership, who aren't hankering after that old kind, the old kind of deference that they used to get.
So the two main things, I guess, that the two main characteristics of liberation theology is that it's more decentralized, and it's also very social change oriented. It's mm-hmm. it's been in Central America and South America a movement of the poor mm-hmm. for equality and participation in that country. Mm-hmm. Do you think that approach to Catholicism will have its own practice in America, or like an interpretation based on Latin America, where the social conditions are very different?
I don't think the base community movement, as it has appeared in Latin America, can be imported into North America. I think there are just too many cultural differences and other differences. But I do think that some of the elements which have made up the base communities movement, lay participation, personal appropriation of the Bible through one's own struggle and thinking and reading and discussing, working out what it means in the social and political realm in one's own life. Those kind of elements, I think, are certainly going to appear, and I've already started to appear in the North American churches, Catholic churches and other churches. But I think it will take its own characteristic form here. And one of the issues that will be central in North America will be the role of women as leaders in these in whatever turns out to be the North American equivalent of base communities.
How do you think the Catholic Church and the mainline Protestant churches are reacting to this phenomenon which you describe, which is a swelling of the religions on the periphery?
Well, differently. I mean, as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, Brazil is in one sense the periphery. In another ironical sense, it's the center. Brazil is now the largest Catholic country in the world. Has the largest Catholic population, larger than Italy or Spain or any other of the countries that you generally think of traditionally as Catholic, more than the United States. And given demographic developments, the center of world Christianity by 2000 AD will not be Western Europe or even the United States. It'll be Africa and Asia and especially Latin America, which is the major Christian continent. So the periphery cannot be ignored in this sense. The periphery is the future. And you'll notice that, for example, in the Protestant churches, the appearance of world leaders more and more who are not European whites. Think, for example, of Desmond Tutu, who just got the Nobel Prize, or Philip Potter from the Caribbean, who is the president of the World Council of Churches. The new president of the World Council of Churches, which is the Protestant worldwide organization, is a Uruguayan Methodist, a Latin American, Emilio Castro, his name is. So in one sense, the periphery is becoming the center. And that sets a whole new kind of agenda for theology and for religious studies. It's a very exciting and interesting time to be in the field that I'm in, and one of the reasons I like doing it is because of that. So that no matter what the European and North American centers of religious and theological leadership think, what they'd like to do, they're presented with a kind of fact of life that they're going to have to deal with.
Well, do you think that they'll change?
Yes, I think they'll change. I think they'll probably change reluctantly because people in leadership generally do change only reluctantly and stubbornly, but I think they will change. And for example, here's a rather dramatic example. Offices in Rome, as you may know, called a Brazilian theologian, Leonardo Boff, who is a liberation theologian, to come to Rome to be interrogated about his views, which is kind of a warning that maybe they didn't think he was going the right way. And according to Catholic canon law, a theologian who's asked to do that is allowed to bring along two fellow priests as his advisors and companions. Boff appeared in Rome with one cardinal and one bishop as his fellow priests, which was a very, very dramatic indication to the people in Rome that this is not some kind of isolated, deviant phenomenon. This is something with strong support across the church. I think that message got across, and they had a nice little conversation, and he was allowed to go home without even a mild censure. So this indicates that the leadership, albeit somewhat reluctantly, will eventually change, I think.
My guest is theologian Harvey Cox. Do you think that with this resurgence of religion, it's going to be less acceptable to be an atheist or an agnostic? Because so many people are returning to religion, whether it's the one they were brought up in or a different one, whether it's mainstream or a new religion or a new interpretation of an old religion. A lot of people have gone back. Do you think that people are getting less tolerant of people who aren't religious?
Well, I hope not. That may be the case. They always say that atheism is always the shadow of whatever religious belief is dominant in a particular period. That is, an atheist is a person who doesn't believe in some particular God. And if we have a religious resurgence, which we certainly are having, there's going to be more reason to have some doubts about some of the ideas of God that are resurgent. So I would think that there might even be an accompanying kind of rebirth of agnosticism. It didn't used to be very much fun to be an agnostic 25, 30 years ago when that really wasn't very unusual. Maybe it'll take a little more thought and a little more gumption to do that now. But I'm one of those people who thinks that religion is always refined and improved by its critics. So if there weren't a few atheists, I think I'd probably have to become one so that they would, so that function could be continued.
There's something I'd very much like to know about you. Was there a point in your life where you considered entering religion, you know, becoming a priest or a cleric instead of becoming a theologian?
Oh, yes. In fact, I consider my becoming a professor of theology something which happened after my original, you might say, my original vocational decision, because I was raised as a raised in a Baptist church here in Pennsylvania, and decided somewhere along the line, I think in college, to become a minister. And I went to divinity school and actually became a minister, was ordained, and was a chaplain for a number of years. In fact, I was a chaplain for a year at Temple University here in Philadelphia. And then I worked also in at Oberlin College. But I got kind of interested in the more theoretical and philosophical side of theology and moved to being more of a teacher and writer and theologian. Some people claim that my teaching style still sounds a little a little like preaching. That may be true. So I don't think of these as being contradictory vocations at all.
What do you see your role now as theologian in a world where religious values are obviously shifting? And where people are religion is obviously very important to a lot of people, whether they're accepting religion in the way they were brought up or interpreting mm-hmm. it in a new way. The question of religion is something that nearly everybody wrestles with, even if they've rejected it. They've rejected it mm-hmm. because they've wrestled with it. You are not a minister. You're a theologian. What connection would you like to have with people who are doing their daily wrestling with the, with mm-hmm. those questions?
Well, I ask myself that question lots of times, and I do a lot of my teaching now actually in Harvard College rather than in Harvard Divinity School. And what I try to do is precisely what you describe. I try to get people to think seriously about whatever religious tradition they were raised in, ones that they've considered, so that whatever decision they make or decisions they make about their ultimate religious affiliation, it's done thoughtfully, it's done reflectively, it's done with some knowledge of the alternatives, it's done with some appreciation for their own and for other religious traditions. I think one of the main temptations to withstand right now for a theologian is to welcome too enthusiastically this return to religion. I think one has to keep one's critical eyes and ears open and look for the possible excesses and misuses of religion, and to keep that kind of critical edge sharp too, because that can happen also. So I think of myself as doing at least those two things, among others.
You think of yourself, I imagine, as being a very religious person, even though you practice as a professor and not as a minister.
Oh, I don't know whether it's very religious or not. I do think of myself as a religious person, but a lot of my forebears here in Pennsylvania were Quakers, and they always had this, I think, very valuable tradition of not being pretentious about your own religiousness, being simplicity. So when simplicity is gained, simplicity, I think, is an important virtue for me. Although I don't always attain it, it's one that I like to strive after.
Just briefly, do you practice your religion in an organized way? Do you go to church services, or do you prefer to do it individually?
I do. I find myself, yes, I get a lot out of attending churches, and I find myself being rather, you might say, syncretistic about this. That is, I sometimes enjoy going to my own traditional Baptist service. I frequently go to Black Baptist churches, which I really get a lot out of. I attend Catholic Mass.
Oh, we have to end now.
Okay.
Sorry. give us the speakers.